You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, Iraq appoints a new Prime Minister, but will the existing one heed American calls to go gracefully?
The government formation process is critical in terms of sustaining the stability and calm in Iraq. And our hope is that Mr. Maliki will not stir those waters.
James Schneider and John Everard will be here to discuss what's next for what remains the Middle East's most troubled country. Medics discuss the ethics of using experimental drugs to treat Ebola victims. African nations claim they're being denied access to vaccines that could save lives. And Hungary's Roma community protests against plans to evict them from their homes. All that, plus some great music and a look at the best exhibitions right here in London. That's all ahead on today's edition of Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty ahead then in the next 60 minutes, but before we begin, let's get the latest news from all around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Bill Bingham. Iraq's President Fouad Massoum has asked the country's deputy speaker to form a new government. Haider al-Abadi has been nominated prime minister by Shia parties instead of the incumbent Nouri al-Maliki. Mr. Maliki says he wants to stand for a third term, and pro-Maliki security forces have taken up positions around the capital, Baghdad. Fighters from the Islamic State group have made substantial gains in northern Iraq in recent months and forced tens of thousands of people from religious minorities to flee their homes. Senior US officials say the Pentagon has begun supplying weapons to the Kurdish Peshmergas who were fighting the militants. It's the first time a major Western power has agreed to provide them with weapons. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says he's much concerned about the activities of the Islamic State, who he calls a bunch of terrorists.
It is of utmost importance to stop their advance. If any of our allies, and in this case, of course, particularly Turkey, were to be threatened from any source of threat, we won't hesitate to take all steps necessary to ensure effective defense of Turkey or any other ally.
Egyptian media say indirect talks between Palestinians and Israelis aimed at ending the hostilities in Gaza have resumed in Cairo. The talks are taking place during a three-day ceasefire brokered by Egypt. Israel wants Hamas, the militant Islamic group that runs Gaza, to disarm as part of a demilitarization of the territory. The Palestinian delegation's demands include the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza, an end to Israel's blockade, an extension of fishing rights off the coast, and the reopening of air and seaports. EU Commission Chief José Manuel Barroso has told Russia's Vladimir Putin not to carry out unilateral military action in eastern Ukraine under any pretext. The two leaders spoke over the phone as the Kremlin announced it was working with the Red Cross on sending a humanitarian aid convoy to the region. The Red Cross has yet to comment. At least 1,500 people have died since Ukraine's new government sent in troops to put down an insurrection by pro-Russian separatists in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions in mid-April. Outgoing Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan says his victory in Turkey's first direct presidential election heralds a new era for the country. He's told thousands of supporters from his AK Party's headquarters in Ankara his victory was for all Turks, not just those who'd voted for him. Mr. Erdogan won 52% of the vote and avoided a runoff. He says he wants to secure more power for the presidency, but his opponents fear an increasingly authoritarian rule. Coordinator of the OSCE's special observer mission, Vilya Aleknaite Abramikene, says Mr. Erdogan's use of his official position gave him an unfair advantage.
As it was noted by many interlocutors, it was clear that one candidate, the Prime Minister of Turkey, was dominant in the media coverage, and this almost certainly was to his benefit when voters entered polling booths to cast their votes for one of three faces on the ballots.
Medical ethics experts at the World Health Organization are meeting to discuss the use of experimental drugs in the fight against Ebola. The virus has now killed more than 1,000 people in West Africa, but two American aid workers who were given an as yet unlicensed treatment appear to be making a good recovery. In Nigeria, where 10 cases of the virus have now been confirmed, health officials say the new treatments are also being considered there. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we'll be unpicking many of those stories from the bulletin in today's programme. We'll be back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Zurich,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Yes, you're listening to Midori House. It's 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York City. And you're with me, Tom Edwards. I'm joined for their take on the big stories of the day here in Studio One by both James Schneider from Think Africa Press and the former British ambassador, John Everard. Welcome both to the programme. Lots to get through. Before we start, I just thought I'd get a view from you both about... Well, what we're sort of hearing, mixed reports, really, in terms of what's happening on the Russian-Ukraine border. Suggestions some 45,000 troops were gathering there. We've since heard that perhaps, the Russians claim they're heading the other direction. We know that EU chief Barroso has urged Putin not to do anything. Moscow insists it's a humanitarian effort, an aid convoy. Anders Fogh Rasmussen amongst those to say, well, that sounds like the pretext for an invasion. John, just firstly, clearly the actual events on the ground are rather unclear. Would Putin be so, I don't know, crude as to try and effect this sort of military manoeuvre, do you think?
Well, he said he will. I mean, we're not in the realm of guesses anymore. The communique after Putin's talk with Barroso said that it was noted that the Russian Federation will send a humanitarian convoy to Ukraine. I think the phrase was in association with the Red Cross. The Red Cross has been very silent since, of course, every journalist in the world has been trying to get a comment from them. The Russians are careful in this kind of statement. If Putin has said that he will do this, he probably means exactly that. Can he be dissuaded? The pressure now will really be on. I think the echoes we're hearing from Barroso and Rasmussen give some flavour of the tone of these conversations. Russia, if it goes ahead and does this, is going to commit political suicide. But do remember that back in 1968, people said that Russia would be committing political suicide, breaking off all relations with the communist parties of Western Europe, if it went into Czechoslovakia. It still did it.
James, I mean, it's an interesting historical point to bear in mind there. Do you think Putin would have the appetite even to commit that sort of political suicide, if you will, that John's described there?
I don't think he's showed too many signs that he wouldn't, which doesn't mean that he necessarily would. I'm not entirely sure how well planned out this has been from before, or whether this is a bit more of the kind of ad hoc play where he works out what situation he is and then tries to act. I mean, the thing that does appear consistent is Putin holding up a kind of ugly, dirty mirror to the West by using similar types of foreign policy language, humanitarian corridor, same thing about responsibility to protect, and holding that up and sort of showing the inconsistency of how that's been applied in supposedly ethical Western foreign policy. And regardless of whether he does go in or not, I think that's a really deep challenge to Western foreign policy, which will have to be met.
We'll obviously keep an eye on the situation there and possibly return to it before the end of the programme. All eyes, though, as we're hearing in our news at the top of the programme, are on Iraq today, as the country moves a step closer to appointing a new and a potentially more inclusive prime minister. Militants, as we know, from the Islamic State have continued to take control of cities in the north, despite the best efforts of various forces, including Kurdish forces, to resist them. The US has carried out airstrikes against the group. Senior American officials today announced they've been arming the Kurds' own army, the Peshmerga. John, I'll start with you. Nouri al-Maliki is infuriated, rejected calls from everyone, both within and without the country, that he should step aside. He's deployed forces loyal to him around Baghdad and other areas. Do you think he'll move on?
No, I think he is digging in. And I think just as we thought the situation in Iraq could not possibly get any worse, Maliki's found a way of making it worse. We're now confronted not just with a vicious Islamic insurgency confronting the Kurds, as you mentioned, but also with what could easily turn quite quickly into a civil war. If Maliki is prepared to use the military muscle at his disposal to protect his own position, then Baghdad itself might be plunged into violence.
Let's look then at what the other actors, the external actors, if you like, James, need to do here. I mean, is it the US's role then now to make sure there is some kind of change effected?
How? I mean, I don't think the US has an enormous number of options to play here. I mean, their credibility is going to be somewhat, you know, damaged with all sides, given that Maliki was placed there as a supposedly, you know, reasonably quiet, reasonably easy person to deal with. And I mean, it's difficult to see what role outside forces can play in what could become not only the reemergence of civil war along sectarian lines within the country, but also the reemergence of intra-Shia civil war, which took place after the invasion and during the insurgency, which wasn't terribly well covered, but was a really big deal. And that sort of got papered over for a bit, and that now could be re-emerging, as it looks like Maliki is trying to play strongman. So, I mean, obviously things are really, really terrible and really messy, but I don't think, I mean, the US doesn't have a silver bullet, and even if it did, whether it would be able to apply it domestically or how it's viewed in Iraq, I mean, I think it would be very unlikely.
Mm. Can I just come in on that? Firstly, I agree with everything that James has said. I think that's exactly right. I think it is very significant that the United States has decided to arm the Peshmerga, the Kurdish militias. They have held off doing this for years and years and years because they feared that doing so would imperil the unity of Iraq. This move means it's very close to a clear US signal that they've effectively given up on Iraq as a unitary state. They've accepted the fact that this is going to splinter.
Well, I mean, I want to ask you about that point more generally then, perhaps not just in Iraq, but across this wider area. Do you think there's a sense from the US administration that perhaps, you know, the Middle East, in terms of what they had originally conceived of, how they saw us emerging from it, you know, back in 2003, you know, it's doomed. The area is sort of beyond their repair. Do you sense that resignation from Washington, D.C.?
I mean, I think there is definitely realism that is creeping in. That, I mean, you know, you look at the relatively limited way in which Obama is acting now with the airstrikes against Islamic State forces, but it's not a huge and wholehearted engagement because there isn't that much we can do. There's the really cruel irony of U.S. policy in Iraq and the broader region is that there was a policy paper that was put forward before the invasion which said, you know, basically after Saddam, Iraq could just fragment into three states and we could do that far more easily without a war, and that's what's happened. But after more than a decade of bloodshed and with the country in a significantly worse position than it would be with its, I mean, you know, obviously with huge numbers of people dead, with lots of facilities and infrastructure destroyed, with a totally changed and in many ways, you know, pretty negative political culture, and with lots of the professionals and educated people who would be part of rebuilding that now fragmented, you know, three states entity, you know, not there, not available.
Another thing not available, if things continue as they are, might well be the oil. If you look at the geography of the fighting between the Kurds and the Islamic State, you can see that the Islamic State seems to be making some gains in the south around Jalawala. But the Kurds have retaken Makmur and Gwer, which means that they are within spitting distance of Kirkuk. Now, I don't, you know, the Kurds have not published a position paper, of course, but I would hazard a guess that one of their objectives is to secure Kirkuk with the oil fields all around it. If we end up with a truncated Iraq without those oil fields, then it faces serious economic problems, quite apart from the ethnic and religious divisions we've been talking about.
I mean, and then if we're confronted with that, of course, it's rather a sort of leap from where we are presently. I guess then personnel in terms of, you know, who's the prime minister, are they a unity candidate? That rather all becomes irrelevant, doesn't it, if you're confronted with a country that's facing
right.
those sorts of immediate problems.
You end up with people squabbling over a corpse. Mm-hmm. The other angle to this, again, a Kurdish angle, is what's going on in Turkey. And Erdogan, as we just heard on the news, and making his first announcement as president, straight away the opposition have said that he attained the position by chicanery, and there are real doubts over whether he is allowed to do what he plans to do under the Turkish constitution. I think there is some possibility that Turkey will be entering a period of some instability while all this is sorted out. And, of course, Turkey is full of Kurds. If there is a moment in which the Turkish Kurds are going to grab an opportunity to unite or federate or whatever with the Iraqi Kurds, this might be it.
And what about the security situation more broadly? Obviously, we talk about the Islamic State threat. You know, it remains on the borders of a number of these areas. Do you think Erdogan, with his new hat on, will be additionally concerned about that before you even start to think about what the how the Turkish Kurdish community might react?
Absolutely. I mean, this must be very high up his list of worries. What he's going to do about it, whether we're looking at a more aggressive Turkish policy in the region, I think we just have to wait to see.
Let's move on and look to Africa next, and more specifically Nigeria, where there have been 10 confirmed cases of the deadly Ebola virus. Several of the victims have died, of course. Announcing this news, the health minister says Nigeria wanted access to some of the new vaccines that are being developed. So the US has already turned down this request. Doctors, of course, have treated several patients seemingly relatively successfully using this, which has prompted these allegations of double standards and discrimination. There's meetings with the WHO in Geneva as well to talk about it. James, what do you make of this? Good Luck Jonathan makes this plea. The resources are not forthcoming. What does that describe? Is it pragmatism on the part of Obama? Is there some inherent sort of almost racism when it comes to allocating these resources? What do you make of it?
I think let's make no mistake, there is a complete double standard that is being made on who gets the drugs. Now, there's a difference between the very, very small numbers of experimental drugs. I saw something which, if they amped up production, you know, they might get 30 doses to give to people next week. It's not as if this is something which their warehouse is full, which they could just bring out, which they're not. But there is a real difference between not giving it to Nigeria and not giving it to Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia, which is that the amount of people who are infected in Nigeria relative to the amount that they have available makes it a plausible thing. It's more difficult to argue that a 76-year-old Spanish missionary should have been given the dose back in Spain, already with superb healthcare, in isolation, and all the rest of it, who picked it up, I think it was in Liberia, rather than that dose being given to a Nigerian doctor infected trying to treat Patrick Sawyer, the sort of patient zero in Nigeria. So there are lots of questions have to be asked. The WHO says it's got nothing to do with the drug being given to the Spanish man. And it is rather complicated, because I mean, you say Obama, but it isn't just the American government. You have different pharmaceutical companies who have these drugs which are in development. They're not complete. They're not ready. They need further testing. There are commercial reasons that they may not want them to come out already. You know, if they are imperfect, given that so much of pharmaceutical R&D spending is on trying to find drugs that are very, very similar to ones you already have, so that rivals don't patent them, they might be reluctant to put them out. So it's not a simple situation. But the fundamental point is, yes, there is very clearly and pretty ugly discrimination that has taken place, and a large inequality has been placed on the value of lives of Africans relative to Americans and Europeans.
And just a different point on that, I guess a tangential point, which is about how resources are then allocated in the battle then to treat Ebola and with these kind of outbreaks. Does that sort of jeopardise the landscape of treatment of other conditions? We know about the tens of thousands of people who are affected every year, for example, by malaria. Are they driven now to redivert what are already scarce resources to tackle this outbreak, which, although very worrying, is still relatively small scale? Is this sort of the greater risk that maybe we see a huge spike in malaria numbers?
Yes, I think this is the, probably the biggest aspect of this, which has been insufficiently covered, is that, you know, in the same period of time when, you know, let's say around 1,000 people in West Africa will have died of Ebola, it's highly likely that because of resources being shifted towards Ebola, but also the fact that Ebola attacks health workers by its nature, because you get it from contact with other victims, that that has probably killed more people from other diseases over the same period, probably many factors more people than Ebola has. And I think once this gets more under control, and actually having looked at how it has been dealt with across the four countries, it's been dealt with within the confines of what was available, you know, actually relatively well. Then it's not like a terrible scandal in any way. Some of it's actually been dealt with extremely well. I think once it's under control, what we should then be looking at is the underlying health issues and these diseases which kill thousands and thousands of people each year, but they don't have any kind of zombie, sci-fi Hollywood blockbuster element to them, which don't necessarily capture the attention.
And John, just on that point about the sort of transnational nature of this, obviously there's quite a lot of discussion, one imagines, that goes on between countries and governments when they may potentially be affected, as in this instance. Are there problems, do you think, with how that liaison is working? Are there problems more fundamentally, perhaps, with some of the international institutions? You know, is the WHO an effective body at dealing with these? Are there any sort of areas of culpability in your view? Of course, you know, we must preface that by saying this is still at a relatively early stage, but potentially.
Yes, I don't think culpability. I think we are observing inefficiencies and injustices in the allocation of resources and the distribution of drugs. And I'm very glad that James made the point that we focus on Ebola, because I love your phrase, the zombie factor. Yes, whereas, you know, if we'd put this amount of money into solving malaria, for which there are effective treatments, Ebola, of course, was still very much the experimental stage, we could probably save a lot more lives. I mean, that was probably the single biggest imbalance, shall we say, in the way that the epidemic is being addressed.
Just one final point there. You say we shouldn't sort of point the finger, but what about drugs companies? You've got Western governments who, you know, arguably are, let's say in DC and here in London, for example, pretty strongly influenced by, that's a powerful political lobby. Is there not a case to say, look, there's a humanitarian need that should come before a profit motive or the interests of a company on a stock exchange?
I would certainly agree with that, but I don't think that the drug companies here are a problem. I think if, you know, hypothetically, you said, you know, Ebola is terrible, but with the amount of money it's going to cost us to cure it, we can actually cure many, many more people of, you name it, malaria or any of the other sort of curable diseases around the world, we would be looking at large contracts for the drugs companies for relatively easily deliverable drugs. I think actually their weight would go to the other side of the scales.
Those are the insights of John Everard and James Schneider, who'll both stay with me because we'll return after a short break, and we'll be looking to Egypt. So do stay with us.
Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture on Monocle 24 is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you never knew you wanted to know about, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 culture shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, still with me, James Schneider and John Everard. Now, Egypt's been accused of riding roughshod over the Democratic Ideals Day by refusing entry to two senior members of the advocacy group Human Rights Watch, who'd been due to present a report on mass killings that took place in the country a year ago, carried out supposedly at the time of this coup by the army, which was, of course, run by the now president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. The results will still be announced as scheduled. And of course, we should think back to the prolonged period of civil unrest that followed these killings of more than 800 pro-Muslim Brotherhood supporters. I'd like to ask you both, a lot to worry about, one imagines, for Sisi and his crew. A pretty unsubtle attempt to make a pretty big problem go away by simply banning these human rights advocates from entering the country.
I mean, it doesn't help his international image, but then he doesn't really have to worry that much about his international image because he has such across-the-board support from world powers. So it really doesn't matter that he's that this will get critical coverage in pretty much, you know, most major newspapers in Western capitals, because he's got, you know, the nailed-on support of John Kerry and the nailed-on support of Catherine Ashton and everybody else. Domestic, I mean, he's thinking domestically, and he, you know, doesn't want anything which can aid in any way the Muslim Brotherhood cause, and that's what this is, and that's what this is seen as. So it will get more publicity than it would have done anyway. I mean, for in some ways, for Human Rights Watch, at least in its advocacy outside of Egypt, it's kind of a coup, because it means it will definitely be covered, rather than just, you know, a news editor getting and going, oh, right, so we now know a bit more about how this horrible massacre happened, when it's, you know, actually was a pretty well-covered event and lots of the details have already come out. So, I mean, sadly, he isn't really in a tight spot over all of the really legitimate criticism that he's receiving.
I'd put it stronger. I think he will tough it out. I think that's quite clear. And not only is he not in a tight spot, he's actually looking pretty good. Mm. I mean, he's got everybody signed up to support him. The fact that he is hosting the talks between the between Hamas and Israel on off is true. But, you know, if there's a peace deal, it will be the Cairo deal. That does no harm at all. And, of course, you talked just now about widespread support. I think Sisi, just as we speak, is in Moscow and looking forward to shaking the hand of a big Vlad tomorrow.
Oh, I was going to ask you about this, because you sort of suggest that he's effectively kind of tweaking the nose of the international community because he can. I mean, how much is that behind that visit, do you think, to visit his Russian friends? I mean, let's talk about potential arms deal. It's interesting to look at the motives for both sides in that. Do you think a strong part of it is simply Sisi riling up people because he knows he's in a position where he can afford to?
I think there's a lot of that. I think there's a bit of NASA coming back, you know, playing West and East off against each other. We've seen Egyptian politicians do this before. Whether Sisi would actually want things like Russian arms, I think, is open to question. But the fact that he's talking to the Russians will upset the Americans. You notice the Apache suddenly got released? So, you know, is there a linkage? I wonder. On the other side, Putin, of course, desperate to get out from under, shunned by the West, shunned by all his major markets. He's just cut off the food supply from the West with the sanctions he's announced. And he's out looking for friends, any friends anywhere. Sisi will do as good as anyone.
Finally, before we let you both leave, I did want to ask about another country with a questionable human rights record. John, that's North Korea, of course, and I know with your knowledge of the peninsula, you may have a view on this. The North Koreans are going to publish their own report countering the, inverted commas, lies and fabrications of a UN investigation on that subject. Pyongyang's rejected those findings strongly and is going to paint, we're told, the true picture of what life's really like in Asia's most infamous military dictatorship, of course. John, again, a serious effort to sort of counter what the UN is saying, or is this a finally discovered sense of humour from our friends in Pyongyang?
No, sadly, I don't think it's a Pyongyang developing a sense of humour, although I suspect that the report, when it comes out, will be avidly read and may well raise a giggle or two. Pictures of smiling, happy children. Perhaps not so much focus on the concentration camps, not so much detail about current execution methods or torture, but lots and lots of very happy citizens. I think, you know, North Korea has a kind of knack of producing propaganda materials that to most of us seem completely zany. I have a sense that this report is really going to take the biscuit on that.
James, just a final thought from you. It is interesting we talk about all the sort of propaganda battles that are being fought around the world. It does seem sometimes that no one No one can quite do it like Pyongyang. Do you sometimes look to North Korea and think, yeah, they've still got the edge on this?
They've really got it. And there's one guy that they've got that I really want to meet who I think he used to be a South Korean film professor or something. And he puts out these amazing YouTube videos of critique of everything that's wrong with the with America from the perspective of North Korea, with lots and lots of references and footage from Hollywood films. And they're a great watch.
So there's your viewing for the rest of the day is taken care of. James Schneider and John Everard, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House, including a look at Hungary's slums with our correspondent. Before all of that, though, let's hear from Bill Bingham, who's here with the latest world news headlines.
Iraq's President Fuad Masum has asked the country's deputy speaker to form a new government. Haida al-Abadi has been nominated prime minister by Shia parties instead of the incumbent Nouri al-Maliki. Mr. Maliki says he wants to stand for a third term, and pro-Maliki security forces have taken up positions around the capital, Baghdad. Egyptian media say indirect talks between Palestinians and Israelis aimed at ending the hostilities in Gaza have resumed in Cairo. The talks are taking place during a three-day ceasefire brokered by Egypt. EU Commission Chief José Manuel Barroso has told Russia's Vladimir Putin not to carry out unilateral military action in eastern Ukraine under any pretext. The two leaders spoke over the phone as the Kremlin announced it was working with the Red Cross on sending a humanitarian aid convoy to the region. The outgoing Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan says his victory in Turkey's first direct presidential election heralds a new era for the country. He's told thousands of supporters from his party's headquarters in Ankara his victory was for all Turks, not just those who'd voted for him. Mr. Erdogan won 52% of the vote and avoided a runoff. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill. More news from Bill Bingham at the top of the hour. That'll be 1900, of course, here in London. It's ticking towards 1832, though, right now. And you're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Time to check in with one of our many correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Budapest, from where we're joined by Adam Labor. Adam, great to speak with you as always. Let's start by talking about, the Prime Minister there. What's he been saying about the United States and relationships between the two countries?
Well, recently the Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, gave a speech in Romania, which has caused a huge stir, in which he said that Hungary would remain a democracy, but would be an illiberal democracy. And he praised China and Turkey and Singapore as a kind of potential models. Now, he's not saying that Hungary is about to turn into a dictatorship, but he's certainly saying that there are other models than what we describe as liberal democracy. And this sent caused a huge fuss here and has also caused some alarm in Washington. And relations with America have been a bit cool lately anyway, and the Americans seem to be particularly concerned about this turn of events. I mean, so far it's only a speech, but it has happened in the context of an increasing centralization of power under the government.
And I just wonder, you know, sort of politically, how damaging could that be if relations have cooled more broadly with the US? Are there, for example, opponents who can make real political capital from the fact that, you know, they can promise to direct the country, you know, back in that direction and restore some transatlantic alliance of some sort?
Well, at the moment, probably not, actually, because the government here, the ruling party Fidesz, is very strong. It just won another two-thirds majority at the last election in April. And the pro-government media is really engaging in a lot of America bashing, talking about Iraq and Guantanamo Bay and torture and all these other dark episodes in American modern history. And that seems to be where, you know, where the support is. And the smaller, the quieter voices saying, actually, you know, we're only 10 million of us and we're quite a small country. It's probably not a good idea to go to war with the world's superpower, verbal war with the world's superpower, which is also a major investor here, are, you know, being kind of drowned out by this chorus of anti-Americanism.
Adam, let's talk a bit more about some more, well, domestic problems, I guess, for Orbán and others to tackle. And one pretty sort of alarming story about these slum clearances. Lots of argument, lots of debate. How would you characterise what we're seeing here? Maybe give us the background to this.
Well, the background is that there's a town in Miskolc, a city called Miskolc in eastern Hungary, which has a very large, very dilapidated area that's populated mostly, largely by Roma, by gypsies. And the town has announced that, you know, they want to clear these slums because it is true that many gypsy people do live in very poor conditions. They, you know, some of them don't have running water or proper connection to the sewage system or electricity. I mean, if you go out, especially to eastern Hungary, see some of the towns and villages, it's like a shanty town in the developing world. And so the government says that, you know, we can't have people living like this. And they say that they'll give them compensation and they're going to knock these places down. But the compensation they're giving them is not very much. It's 2 million forints, which is approximately like £7,000 or £8,000. I mean, and you can't buy a house or a flat even in eastern Hungary for £7,000 or £8,000. So many of the Roma activists there are saying that they're being, you know, essentially cleansed out of their home to make way for, you know, development. I mean, one of the slums that's being knocked down is going to be replaced by a car park for a football stadium. So it doesn't seem, you know, there are arguments on both sides, but there's clearly a lot of very unhappy people about this process, the ones that are on the receiving end.
And Adam, I just wonder, I mean, what's the sort of the pro-Roma lobby, if you will, in the country? And is it well represented, or is this something of a silent struggle? It's clearly politically quite controversial, but, you know, what's the sort of view of the common man? Are there people who, you know, speak out in defence of these people?
Yes, there is. I mean, there is a pro-Roma lobby, and there's Roma organisations as well. But it has to be said that the Roma organisations spend a fair bit of their time kind of squabbling with each other. And one of the great problems of the whole kind of Roma issue over Eastern Europe is that it's been very difficult for the community to develop good leaders that can really take on the system. The ones that have emerged, some of them have either gone off to work for, you know, one of the foundations that George Soros set up, or they've been sucked into the political system themselves. So there's not many kind of genuine voices there. And it's also the case that there's very widespread prejudice against gypsies across Eastern Europe, in Hungary and in all of its neighbours. And there's not a lot of sympathy for them among, it's not universal, but it is, it's widespread.
Let's just finish on a lighter note, Adam, and talk about, well, back in Budapest, an arts festival. Paint the picture, if you will, for this.
Yes, the Central European Visual Arts Festival is happening at the moment in Budapest, in the city park by the lake, which is a very beautiful place. It started on August the 10th, and it's going to go, sorry, on August the 7th, and it's going to go on for a couple of weeks. And we've got some really wonderful events here, like evening literature salons and artist workshops, poetry, films being screened. There's a screening of the film about Vivian Mayer, the amazing photographer, the nanny in Chicago who died, leaving thousands and thousands of prints and photographs behind that no one really knew about. So you're seeing a good mix here of visual arts and also music and sound and theatre. And it's a reminder, you know, that as ever, despite Hungary's kind of turbulent and difficult politics, this is a country with a wonderful artistic and cultural tradition.
Indeed. So get on down to Budapest is the message there. Thanks, Adam, very much. That's Adam Labor, our man in Budapest. And more arts up for discussion next. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because dragstar taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
For the second of our two film reports on the summer-long Venice Architecture Biennale, Monocle Films investigates this year's theme of fundamentals, set by chief curator Rem Koolhaas.
This exhibition comes across as architectural navel-gazing, an industry looking far too deeply into itself and alienating everyone else in the process. But it showed how architecture is not simply about the built environment. It's about the political, social, psychological environments that architectural elements build and how these environments have been built and used so differently around the world.
A cinematic exploration of elements and fundamentals at this year's Venice Architecture Biennale, now playing in the film section of monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House, here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, they say secrets are no fun unless you share them with everyone. And that's certainly true of the Edinburgh Fringe show Outings, which features sketches about coming out of the closet, sometimes to great comic effect and sometimes to dramatic effect too. Four actors bring these tales to life. Each performance, they're joined on stage by a special guest who also joins in the action. At a time when several big-name celebrities have shown it's in to come out, these less flashy anecdotes are provided by ordinary members of the public, many of them submitted via the show's own website, the idea being they could belong to anyone. I'm delighted to say we're joined now by one of the show's writers, Thomas Heskett. Thomas, great to speak with you. Thanks very much for joining us. I mentioned in the introduction there that, you know, there is comic effect, there's moments of levity, but ultimately this is a pretty serious subject. Is the underlying message, do you think, of your feature here, you know, that this is a serious subject that people need to address more readily?
I'm not sure if there's an underlying message as such. I think it's about sharing the stories and about people identifying with them, whether they're gay, straight, bi, whatever, having that ability to connect with the stories and to identify with that idea of secrets and that and the challenges that those secrets can have. There's probably as many messages as there are stories, but there's not one specific message within there.
And just tell us first of all about how this actually happens then, because it's quite an interesting creative process. We're used to sort of, you know, writers sitting in their garrets writing away in the wee hours of the night, but this is a much more sort of immersive thing. It invites these contributions. How exactly does that work? Do the stories, as you receive them, make their way directly onto the stage? Describe the process to us a little.
Not every story that comes to us gets on stage. It will. It always depends on what the story is, whether we have one that's like it, which story works best dramatically, I guess. But over the course of the last 5-6 months, something like that, we've heard, read, spoken to probably about 100 different people with different stories. A lot of those come through our website. And then we've also gone out and searched out certain stories ourselves. Because also there's certain parts of the world or certain generations where those stories weren't as readily available, so we went out to find those. And as they came in, we sort of went through each one, we read every single one, and we met a lot of people and interviewed a lot of people, and we gradually started to build that up until we had a 70-minute show. In fact, I think we probably got about 10 70-minute shows at the moment. But what happens now is, the show itself has a clear structure and is fixed, but we know that certain stories are meant to have a certain effect, play a certain role within the whole play. So then if another story comes in, as happened on our first preview, that we thought did that better than the story we had in there at the time, then we'll swap it out and put another one in so we can react very quickly to what comes in.
And Thomas, I guess once you're, you know, tasked with overseeing a creative project like this, it must be tricky to sort of choose favourites. But I don't know, are there a couple of examples of stories that you just found were the most impactful and the most affecting? Do you sort of have favourites?
Oh, God, do I have favourites? there's some stories that we haven't included that I wish we could have done. The boy who came out to his whole school during a public debating competition. That's sort of in there in a small way, but there's much more in that story that's really interesting and lovely. I don't know, that's like asking me to choose favourite children. I can do that.
Well, maybe you can answer me this then, because obviously we're talking about the comic elements and this kind of serious undertones. Did you find that, generally speaking, the stories you received from members of the public were kind of sadly, grimly believable, or was there always an element of sort of almost fantasy where you wondered whether these were almost constructs or people rewriting their own history?
It's funny, there was a little bit of one of the stories we ended up cutting because we felt that it felt like it had possibly been told so many times it had been slightly reconstructed. The story itself's in there, but there was quite a neat ending. And we initially kept it in there because we thought, oh, maybe it probably did happen. But then as we went on with this, went, oh, this is a bit too Hollywood an ending. And so we took it out. We quite like the fact that people do embellish, embrace, and sort of retell their stories. And that's part of it. We don't want them to be dry sort of statements. We want that the same feeling you have when you're sitting next to a friend or someone you know really well, and they're sharing the secret with you. We want that same kind of live feeling of someone who's retelling it. I would say, having said that, I don't think anything in the stories, although some people took great pleasure in the way they told us the stories, I don't think there's anything in there that necessarily would be untrue, and we've certainly not embellished them. I think, why would you write in with an untrue story to a website or meet us to be interviewed and for them to be untrue? So I think they all hold a truth about them, but the way we tell the stories is always fun and inventive. The way people tell them to us, often they have their jokes and they have their way of telling them that we like to kind of embrace.
Now, Thomas, also tell me a little bit about this idea of involving this sort of rotating cast of guest stars, if you like, with your regular cast. How does that sort of affect the dramatic process? Is it to get a very different dynamic on stage? Does that indeed happen, or does the sort of strength of the stories prevail? What's that sort of balance like?
Well, what we wanted, the producers suggested to us right at the beginning, and they came to us with this project and asked us to get involved, and they said that they wanted the cast to rotate to some extent, which we really liked, because it is that sense that these are everyman stories, that anyone, these stories can be told by anyone at any time, any place, that it isn't some great performance being given. It's about remaining true to the story. So that's sort of where the idea came from, I guess. What our guest does is we juxtapose the stories that are from members of the public with celebrity stories. And those are very much taken from newspapers, YouTube, things like that. So obviously Tom Daly coming out on YouTube, Ellen Page recently at the Human Rights Conference, but then going right way back to, say, Justin Fashanu's outing by the Sun newspaper, and we tracked down a copy of that. And those kind of comings out. So our guest tracks those and reads those comings out through from 1970, from a political speech by Harvey Milk, through to Ellen Page the other month. So that's what their role is. Yeah, and what's wonderful is we had Scott Capurro do it today, and I saw him do it the other week, and he gets Harvey Milk spot on. But his take on the Sun newspaper is very gossip maggy. We had the comedian Tom Allen do it the other day, and he got the Sun newspaper, that kind of tabloid journalist. So they all present the stories in a slightly different way, and you hear different things in them when they present them.
So you can see all of those varied performances, depending on which show you get to see. Maybe you just remind our listeners where and when they can catch this then, Thomas, at the present.
We're running at the Gilded Balloon in Edinburgh in the Debating Hall at 1 p.m. right the way throughout the Fringe.
Lovely stuff. Thomas Hescott, one of the writers of Outings, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House. Staying on that theme, musically at least, next on Midori House, let's go outside. This is George Michael. That was George Michael with Outside. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, where it's our review time, the best and worst in TV, cinema, theatre, books. Today we're talking, well, a broad swathe of art and culture with the inimitable Peter York, who joins me now. Peter, welcome to Midori House. Great to have you with us.
Lovely to be here.
As always. Now, in fact, we were just chatting with Thomas up in Edinburgh, at the Edinburgh Festival, and I gather your summer summer's cultural edification will take in a trip to Edinburgh, well, when? Yes. I guess next week at some point.
It will be, no, I go for the tail end for the Edinburgh Telefestival, which means you can have a bit of the rest. So I'm already booked to the Arthur Smith show and the Nancy DeLolio show. There will be others.
Fantastic. And I wonder, is this sort of fixture on your cultural calendar,
yes,
heading out to Edinburgh?
I've been going there for years.
And it's interesting. Tens of years. Do you sort of eschew certain parts? Do you sort of avoid the vagaries of the fringe? Do you prefer the telly festival?
To the telly festival. That's a fixed and absolute thing. The telly festival, is a sort of trade do, really. Mm. Though telly people don't like to see themselves as in that, because it's in one place at one time over 4 days with a set menu. And you choose off that. Anyway, it's wonderful. You have to do it. If you would have the vaguest aspiration ever to make any telly, you have to go there. Mm. But you learn things and you meet people. And then around that, I sometimes go a bit early. And around that, you can do other stuff. You can go to other things. You can have dinner with friends who are doing shows and stuff like that. And then at the end of the day, you can go to the bumping jellyfish or whatever it might be called. What's the one with the upended pig or the upended cow? You know what I mean.
Oh, yeah, the famous underbelly.
The underbelly. The underbelly, yes. You can go there and then you might find yourself somewhere else at 3 a.m, which is always good.
That sounds like another chat that we should have when you've perhaps returned, Peter.
Yes.
Now, let's talk a little bit. Let's go for our sort of summer cultural constitutional back through London and what's been catching Peter York's attention. And I know you've been a busy man. You've visited various things. Let's look back to maybe a couple of the highlights. I know there was an exhibition at the V&A that you wanted to talk to us about.
Yes, because it's a nice counterpoint to all the sorts of things we talk about and all the sorts of things that we see at Edinburgh and in our normal Cork Street round. And that is William Kent at the V&A. William Kent was the creator of the first big Hanoverian look, the big Hanoverian bling look. Hanoverian Baroque with a lot of gold. And unfortunately, the V&A show wasn't nearly big enough because the places he did, because he became a royal take-up and a big aristocratic take-up, he decorated, and that is the right word for him. He was that integrated decorator. So he designed houses which other people built, and then he designed their decoration, and then he designed to some extent the furniture that was in them. That's the role of a decorator. You know instantly that people who used to be called decorators don't like to be called it. That's a bad word. If you say it to them, they hiss. You have to say interior designer or interior architect. But Kent was a decorator on a grand scale, and people might say, he wasn't that good. He'd stolen for a lot of from Italians. But in fact, if you were the Hanoverians, you'd feel, I owe you a lot, Mr. Kent, because you've given me a grand English style, a grand Anglo-Italian style. You've de-Germanized me.
It was an amazing sort of transformational period, wasn't it, in British culture. We don't have that long left, Peter, so I want to mention a couple of other things that you were keen to raise. Now, many people who frequent London or Londoners will notice the cross-rail effect, all sorts of
cross-rail effect
on the community. There's some interesting sort of artistic offshoots.
This is a lovely thing that a friend of mine, Julie Leonard, started off her a great acquaintance with transport by doing iPhone sketches on the tube. And at a time when I was writing a book about the tubes, I was completely fascinated to see these wonderful, and they're rather in the style of Richard Bernstein's interview magazine covers. They're in that style. They're very, very nice indeed. And they're very quickly done, sometimes secretly done, of recumbent people. And now she is the artist in residence, get that, of Crossrail. So, not only are there people, but there are big scenes and construction and all sorts of scenes involved, but using the same technology, which is the technology that David Hockney did in his great recent RA exhibition, which was as good as it was bad.
And Peter, what is this? It almost seems part art, part sort of archive, part social archive. Is that the
kind
of role
for it? It's part art. Yes, because they want her to record this extraordinary thing. So it's recording the thing as well as being... it's not decoration for stations. It's recording the event. And they want to be like... Of course, they want to be like the Tube, great patrons of the arts.
And just very, very briefly then, so where do we get to see these things? Will they be appearing in the finished project, or is it a sort of an ongoing curatorial process?
They had a quite recent show in a place, I have to say, near Hangar Lane Gyrator, very near the Hangar Lane Gyratory system.
All international points here.
All international points here, but it will shortly, I gather, be exhibited on in a rather more central venue as Crossrail becomes a real part of our lives.
We'll have to keep an eye on that. Peter York, thank you very, very much
My
indeed
very
for joining
pleasure.
Us here on Midori House. That's all for today's programme. Thanks to James Schneider and John Everard, who were our special guests today. The show is produced by Marika Peters. That's all for today. Goodbye.
From London to Beijing,
this is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.